National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The Bishop of Charlotte in North Carolina has postponed a plan to place severe restrictions on the traditional Latin Mass in his diocese after a pretty significant backlash. This is the latest development in what is not just a wide-reaching liturgical controversy within the Western North Carolina portions of the church, but across much of social media and the international church, the universal church, as well. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Jonathan Liddle, Register Senior Editor, to discuss not just this story and the potential ramifications for the implementation and living of the Second Vatican Council, but a number of other stories that are worth catching up with Jonathan about. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President and Editorial Director for EWTN News, and your host here for Register Radio, joined by my co-host, Shannon Mullen. I'm in Birmingham this week, and Shannon is in Washington, D.C. Shannon, great to be with you.
Great to be with you and Jonathan as well.
Well, let's just say that in your capacity as our editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and also co-host here on Register Radio, this is a story that kind of came out of nowhere some weeks back. Have you been surprised at just the sheer controversy surrounding all of this?
Yeah, it's actually one of the questions I had for Jonathan. I'm not sure what we were expecting, right? We knew this was still out there, still a pretty hot and contentious issue, a new pope. So, you know, there was a lot of speculation about what he may or may not do with regards to the traditional Latin Mass. And yet, you're right, it really did kind of blindside us. I guess, and maybe this is a good way to get into it with Jonathan, I guess we thought that the bishops who were dealing with this issue in their diocese might have given Leo a little more time to,
right,
you know, signal in what his wishes are with respect to some of these liturgical questions.
Yeah, well, let's bring in Jonathan Liddle, our senior editor for the National Catholic Register. Jonathan, welcome.
Great to be with you both.
Well, we haven't had an opportunity to have you on for a while, so welcome back to Register Radio. And boy, this is quite an interesting story to come back to the show on, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, as we were talking about it, it's obviously a controversial issue in the Diocese of Charlotte itself, which has had a pretty burgeoning sort of traditionalist community for a number of years. It's a story, of course, that comes in within the first month of Pope Leo XIV's reign, and so it's seen as, in many ways, a potential indicator of how he might lead the church forward amidst these seemingly never-ending liturgy wars. And then, of course, you know, as we'll get into, it is one of the sort of latest instantiations of sort of the ongoing dispute about, like, what Vatican II actually taught with regards to the liturgy, and what reforms it called for and what it didn't call for. So it's, you know, it's one diocese, it's in Western North Carolina, but it has a lot of implications for the wider church.
Yeah, and that very dimension, you used the term liturgy wars. We have seen them percolating over the last few years since the implementation and promulgation and then various additional implementations of Traditionis Custodes by Pope Francis that was intended to regulate, some have used the term, crackdown on the traditional Latin Mass. Should we be surprised, though, that given the set of circumstances of Pope Francis's declining health, that a bishop would choose at that particular moment, because we know that his decree was initially written before Pope Francis's passing, that to launch this sort of a crackdown, what was the thinking behind that?
Yeah, I think there are, as you say, a lot of indications that this was in the works well before the May 23rd announcement from Bishop Michael Martin in Charlotte, that he was restricting the traditional Latin Mass from four parishes in Charlotte to just one chapel. Yeah, I think at the very least we can say when a new pope is elected that it might be a time to sort of pause. We know, of course, during the Sede Vacante period, the period when we don't have a pope, that basically the whole church goes on ice in a lot of ways. You know, there's technically no heads of dicasteries. Papal nuncios aren't really up to anything because they don't have a pope to represent. And I think something similar might apply, sort of the common wisdom, to, you know, the first few months of a new pontiff's reign, especially, as we've indicated, over something as controversial as the traditional Latin Mass and associated allowances going forward. So I think, like, that's the question here. Pope or Bishop Martin definitely did not need to make these restrictions. Traditionis Custodes calls for essentially the elimination of the TLM at parish churches, but the Diocese of Charlotte under his predecessor had actually received an extension from the Vatican not to move forward with those restrictions until October of this year. So Bishop Martin doing this in May, set to go into effect in July, was seen by a lot of people as kind of jumping the gun and maybe even sort of preempting Pope Leo, like getting ahead of Pope Leo and wanting to impose these restrictions in advance of whatever the new Pope might say or might indicate about how the TLM will be celebrated or permitted going forward.
Jonathan, at the center of this story is Bishop Michael Martin, who's new himself, right? Just last week, I believe, he marked his one-year anniversary as the bishop in Charlotte. What else do we know about him?
Yeah, Bishop Michael Martin is a conventional Franciscan, so a member of a religious order. You're right, he's only been in Charlotte for 1 year. May 29th it was the one-year anniversary. Before that, he was a pastor in the Archdiocese of Atlanta. Before that, Shannon, this, of course, personal connection for you, but he was the chaplain of Duke's Catholic community. Exactly, go Blue Devils. I don't know if a Catholic can be a fan of Blue Devils or not, but he definitely has a long experience in campus ministry. In fact, this week he appeared up here in South Bend, Indiana, at the University of Notre Dame for a conference on campus ministry. He's known for being a pretty compelling and charismatic homilist as well. But I think what a lot of people are sort of questioning or wondering about with what we've seen, and one thing we haven't gotten to, is not just the restrictions on the TLM, but a leaked draft of widespread liturgical norms that he wanted to impose in Charlotte, which would have restricted Latin from all liturgies, not just the TLM, but the Novus Ordo too. There's really questions right now in terms of really sort of his management style. Like, is he listening enough, especially in a moment where synodality is still talked about, this emphasis on listening and journeying together? We have a bishop who, within 1 year of his tenure in a new diocese, sought to make pretty significant changes, pretty significant restrictions that really would disrupt a lot of Catholics' liturgical life in his diocese. You know, there's an old rule of thumb: when you become the new pastor of a parish, and this is something that's told to, like, young priests, right, who are excited to make all kinds of changes and things like that. But the rule of thumb is you wait 1 year at your new parish before you make some kind of shift. And so I think it's really striking to a lot of people to see Bishop Martin make such significant moves, restricting the TLM, at the very least proposing or drafting liturgical norms that would ban Latin, would ban the St. Michael the Archangel prayer at the foot of the altar, would ban women from wearing chapel veils when they canter or lecture at Mass, would ban altar rails. These were all seen as, like, very restrictive impositions to make so early. So I think there are a lot of questions about Bishop Martin and his leadership style going forward.
Yeah, a couple things we ought to mention. One is that Jonathan has reached out to the diocese and to Bishop Martin seeking comment. They've given us a couple of comments, but you know, we continue to be open to hear more from him about his reasons. And let's get to those reasons a little bit. Before we do, though, and this might be a good bridge to the broader piece you're working on about Vatican II, there was a edict of sorts at Duke, my alma mater, related to kneeling and standing during communion. Can you briefly touch on that? And what was the justification for then Father Martin at that point?
Yeah, Father Martin, when he was the chaplain of Duke's Catholic community, he issued a requirement that no one kneel during Mass. So no one kneel, for instance, during the Eucharistic prayers, when it is actually the standard, what's called for in the germ, that the faithful kneel during those prayers unless a dispensation is granted. So Father Martin at the time said, we're not going to do that. Now, why aren't we going to do that? Well, because the chapel at the time didn't have kneelers, right? It didn't have those cushion pads for people to kneel upon. And some people attending Mass there due to health reasons or other factors might not be able to kneel. So Bishop Martin's, or at Father Martin's justification at the time was, this is for unity in the liturgy. If one person can't kneel, none of us are going to kneel. And it's a certain approach to liturgy during the unity, and really a view of participation that we see kind of shot through a lot of his other ideas about the liturgy. For instance, Latin, right? He says that in these a draft of his liturgical norms, he says that Latin should basically be banned from all church liturgies because people don't understand Latin. We don't speak Latin. We're not fluent in Latin. Latin scholars might be able to participate in a Mass where Latin is used, but for other people, it's a barrier. For other people, it's going to present their full active and conscious participation in the Mass. That's his argument that he's used there. But it's really, I think, similar to what we see with other things he's done regarding altar rails, and as you mentioned, simply kneeling during the Eucharistic prayers.
Yeah, which raises so many intriguing questions. As somebody I know posted on X, and several people have asked this, so if Latin is being banned also from the Novus Ordo, does that mean that Greek is also banned? So are we now forbidden in this diocese to, for example, say the Kyrie? And Amen itself is technically Hebrew, so I guess it's somewhat tongue-in-cheek in the question, but it does raise a lot of very intriguing and I think important questions about the role of Latin, mm-hmm. and you just mentioned mm-hmm. the germ, so the general instruction of the Roman Missal. That obviously is supposed to be the norm for how Masses mm-hmm. are celebrated, even the Novus Ordo, but Bishop Martin does seem to be, at least on paper, going beyond that, or at least that was in the draft.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a fact that a number of people pointed out. He says that the church did not envision widespread use of Latin, or use of Latin really, in the liturgy. But we can go to Sacrosanctum Concilium, which is the pastoral constitution from Vatican II, and we can go to, as you mentioned, Matthew, the general instruction for the Roman Missal, which is sort of the guiding text for how we celebrate the Novus Ordo in the Catholic Church. And it explicitly says, even though, of course, allowances are made for the vernacular, especially when it comes to the readings of the Mass and things like that in order for those to be accessible to people, it explicitly says that the faithful should be instructed when it comes to the ordinaries, those prayers we pray every single Mass. So think of the Our Father, think of the Sanctus, the Holy, 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 or the Agnus Dei, the Lamb of God. The germ says, because so many faithful from all parts of the world get together for Mass so much these days, it's actually a good thing that people know Latin. It's actually a good thing that they can pray these prayers in a language that, you know, is the patrimony and still the official language of the Catholic Church. And, you know, the point you raise about Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, right, the Greek expression of Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, we know what those, you know, Kyrie eleison, I know nothing about Greek grammar, like, at all. I can tell that Kyrie must mean Lord because Christe means Christ, right? And then eleison must mean something like have mercy. But I know nothing about the particulars of that Greek language. But I know what it means, right? I know what its English equivalent is. And therefore, when I say Kyrie eleison, I'm clearly saying something to the effect of Lord have mercy. And I think you're right. It's peculiar to, in the draft of his liturgical norms, I think what was most shocking was not these various, you know, bans, right? We've seen these in other instances, but it was Bishop Martin sort of presenting his reasoning and his understanding of Vatican II for making some of these restrictions, which again violates, or seems to, you know, contradict what Vatican II actually said in the authoritative text since then. But some of it just doesn't add up. Like, if we can say Lord have mercy in Greek, I can say, you know, Agnus Dei and know that means Lamb of God. I don't have to be a Latin scholar to know that, I think, is the argument that a lot of people would would put forward.
So many different aspects that we're going to have to unpack here, but let's take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation with Jonathan Liedl. You're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Don't go anywhere. Come right back.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, your host of Register Radio and Vice President, Editorial Director for EWTN News. Joined, as always, by Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. And we're continuing our conversation with Jonathan Liedl, Senior Editor for the National Catholic Register. And in focus this week is the decision, apparent decision, on the part of the Bishop of Charlotte in North Carolina to place, or at least have a draft, to place even more restrictions on the traditional Latin Mass and the immense fallout that has ensued. Well, Jonathan, when we went to break, we were talking about the importance of language and obviously the apparent desire on the part of Bishop Martin in Charlotte to restrict the use of Latin, apparently even in the Novus Ordo. But let's take a quick look also at Pope Leo XIV. What does his election portend, at least from what we know at this point? He seems very precise in matters of liturgy, and I think all of us are wondering what he is going to do with Traditionis Custodis, aren't we?
Absolutely. In terms of what it portends, I think one of the ironies about Bishop Martin's liturgical norms and the sort of crackdown on Latin in the liturgy is that we have a pope who uses Latin in the liturgy. And of course, if you go to the Vatican, many of the liturgies celebrated at the Vatican incorporate Latin precisely because it is a universal language meant to be diffused throughout the universal church. So I think I think at least in how he's celebrating the liturgy already, that's giving many people pause to say, okay, do we have a different approach here from his predecessor, Pope Francis? I think another thing, kind of underscoring all of Pope Leo's efforts right now, is his stated focus on unity. Pope Leo, elected May 8th, I think is very aware that he has, you know, come to the See of Peter at a time when the Catholic Church is deeply divided internally over a number of different issues, and this includes over liturgical issues. Traditionis Custodes, which was Pope Francis's apostolic letter restricting the traditional Latin Mass in 2021, was made because the Pope Francis at the time thought that would bring about unity, but it's clearly contributed to ongoing disputes, ongoing divisions. And if Pope Leo, whose motto is episcopal motto, in illum uno unum, in the one Christ we are one, if he's as focused on unity as he says he is, we know that he's going to take trying to resolve some of these disputes in the liturgy to heart. We may have indications of that already. So Bishop Martin on May 23rd said, I'm going ahead with the restrictions of the traditional Latin Mass in Charlotte. Now, June 3rd, we have Bishop Martin backtracking and saying, well, actually, I'm going to pause or delay pushing those implementations forward. There's a lot of speculation over, was that prompted by Rome? Was that prompted by Pope Leo the 14th. I'll just say this, Matthew. It's very hard to imagine a bishop pausing or delaying his restrictions of the traditional Latin Mass during the pontificate of Pope Francis. That's something if a bishop wanted to, he might seek an extension. But if a bishop wanted to restrict the traditional Latin Mass, I don't think we ever saw an instance of him delaying that and possibly due to Vatican pressure. So I think we might have a Leo effect already in at least slowing down some of these restrictions on the TLM. I think it's a very open question, though, about what more we might see from Pope Leo on this front.
Jonathan, you're working on another piece, which is pulling back a lot on this issue in Charlotte to look at some of the bigger themes. And let's remember that when Pope Francis issued Traditionis Custodes, which putting those restrictions on the traditional Latin Mass, that, one of the justifications was that he felt that there was some disunity and maybe even some denialism as to the legitimacy of the reforms, liturgical reforms, under Vatican II. So we only have a few minutes, but the bigger piece, and how does Vatican II fit into this?
Yeah, I think really at the heart of it, this is, you know, some people might think it's trite, but I think this idea that Pope Benedict XVI talked about, do we have a hermeneutic, a lens of continuity or one of rupture? So when we look at Vatican II and Sacrosanctum Concilium, and it's called to reform the liturgy, it's called to enhance the full active and conscious participation of the laity in the celebration of the Mass. It's called for some allowances of the vernacular. It's called to simplify elements of the Mass that had become repetitive. Do we look at what this kind of general ethos of reform that Sacrosanctum Concilium lays out for how to think about the liturgy and how to celebrate it moving forward? Do we look at that as, okay, this is, we're going to interpret this in light of, you know, the 1,950 years that came before it, or do we look at this as a radical break from everything? Do we look at it as, you know, like carte blanche to essentially make all kinds of changes to the liturgy? So I think that's kind of, I think, an overarching sort of question when it comes to Vatican II, not just its teaching on the liturgy, but Vatican II in general. And then I think we can get into specifics of what the Council taught. So this question of participation, for instance, what does it mean, active participation? We know that the Latin word to describe this is not activa, it's not participatio activa, it's actuosa, which some people say translates more to actual. Instead of like frenetic activity, it's more about your heart and your mind being united to the sacrifice of the Mass. So there are all kinds of disputes about, well, what does it mean to have active participation? In fact, there's a legendary story in the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis, where I'm from, where a priest, you know, the Novus Ordo Mass was being celebrated, and he had a stopwatch that he would click on and off during the Mass. And at the end of it, he held it up and he said, you know, there was only 30 seconds where the lay faithful were talking and I wasn't. So there's not enough active participation here. That's one vision, a very egalitarian view of participation, of course. But there are others that say, well, the most fundamental participation is the lay faithful uniting themselves and their lives to the sacrifice of the Mass. And that doesn't require them to sort of become, you know, do what the priest does in every sort of instance. So there are all kinds of disputes about what these broad principles actually mean in context. And I think those are still very much being fought over. One thing I'd point out is that I talked to Chris Karstens, who's with a group called Adoremus, and they emphasize this, you know, the reform of the reform and the hermeneutic of continuity. And he says, you know, 20 years ago, these liturgy wars were all being fought, but it was all, you know, questions of abuses of the liturgy, right? Like, are we going to allow glass chalices? Are we going to allow the laity to come up to the altar during the consecration? He says that's not so much what's being disputed now. Now it's a dispute of how much of the church's sort of more traditional patrimony, the use of Latin, altar rails. It's questions about how much of that is going to be reincorporated into the liturgy going forward. So it's been over 60 years since Vatican II, and these liturgy wars are still ongoing, but I think it is possible to detect shifts within them. And what that says for the future, unclear. But we'll have to keep on paying attention to Pope Leo, I think, going forward.
Yeah, this is a question for a much wider discussion across the church. And as you say, we're waiting to see what Pope Leo does with this on this front and a variety of other ones. But let's, in the very brief time that we have left, I want to give a shout out to a piece that you did on the title of it, and you can find it at ncregister.com, is The Architect Who Fought Modernism and Inspired a Sacred Architecture Revival. We're talking about Duncan Stroik, who is a leading figure of the traditional National Sacred Architecture Revival that has been happening in the U.S. And I know, Jonathan, you had a chance to spend a little bit of time with him. Anyone who knows Duncan, as you write, he is bespectacled and bow-tied. The renowned church architect cuts the figure of the Yale-educated professor. He is far more than any kind of a combatant. And yet, boy, he is something of a lion in this field, isn't he?
Absolutely. And, you know, he really views what he's doing by emphasizing the sacred in architecture is fighting some kind of battle. And, you know, the reality is that when we build buildings, we're saying things about our understanding of who we are as human beings. And when we build a church, we're saying something about our understanding of what worship is, our relationship to God, and what the human heart and imagination needs. And so Duncan Stroik has been really the champion of this kind of revival, which has taken place over the past 30 years or so. He's definitely sort of advanced, if you will, through some of the beautiful buildings he's built, but also through his classroom instruction. And there's really a sense in which there's a new generation of sacred architecture architects in the U.S. who are going to carry the mantle forward.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, I would encourage everyone to read your piece. I know you have another piece coming out on the Charlotte controversy, so thank you for that. And it's great to have you back on Register Radio, and I look forward to having you again soon.
Great to be with you both. Thanks so much.
Well, that's it for this week here on Register Radio. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, go to ncregister.com. On behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, as well, of course, Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week, please take care and God bless.